1 through 7. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no delight in them. Before the sun and the light, the moon and the stars are darkened, and clouds return after the rain. In the day that the watchmen of the house tremble, and the mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand idle because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim, and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. And one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home while the mourners go about in the street. Remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the well is shattered, and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it.
First of all, Stephen, for the reading of Ecclesiastes, which is our opening passage for the lesson. Kind of a hard read and a lot of figurative language and stuff, but I hope we get the point across as we need to very early in life begin thinking about God. Appreciate Dave coming up and his confession and his desire to get back on track with the right things to be done. And we appreciate the presence of everyone here. We're encouraged by your choice of worshiping with God's people and your enthusiasm for God's word. And we hope to be uplifting and edifying to you with the message this morning. Obviously, it's going to be a kind of message that's directed to the young people. So hopefully you'll put down your games and try not to fall asleep on me. But it's kind of for everybody, too, if you realize that when one of the things we're going to point out is Paul's admonition to Timothy not to let him despise his youth. And Timothy is roughly about 45 or 50 at the time. So that kind of includes most of the crowd here. The passage in Ecclesiastes was written by one of the wisest men who ever lived. And therefore, his words should carry some weight in our consideration of how to approach life. Over that of perhaps some teachers we have and our friends. In truth, many of the books of the Bible are written for the young. Proverbs is especially geared for the young. The last part of Proverbs is sort of like a bunch of collection of bumper stickers to get through various circumstances. But the first 10 chapters is actually a father sitting down with his son and explaining, well, we might say, the facts of life and the things to be careful of and the things to be concentrating on as he makes his way through life. Ecclesiastes is a good book to, as you start on, consider various avenues that you might want to focus on. The ecclesiastical writer takes them to their natural conclusion without God in the mix, and how futile they can be and how unfruitful they can leave one's life if family and job and everything else does not have God considered in it. Song of Solomon has been termed an appropriate book for the young and what true love is about or how it should be considered. Daniel, the first 3 chapters, concern young people, teenagers, carried off into captivity, where they have to deal with problems and their choices they have to make in a strange land, strange customs, strange language. And then Timothy also, as Paul leaves him to, in charge of an area around Ephesus and the Ephesus church itself and trying to deal with their problems. One should remember their Creator in all things, in their obedience to the gospel, in their daily Bible reading, in their daily prayer, especially when they are young. Now is the time in your youth to set your habits in a right direction. Habits, behaviors, attitudes, everything should be starting to set in when you're early so that you're not deviate from them, because it's hard to change when you get a little older. This may be the only time also you have. James says our life is but a vapor. And more young people are dying early. You think, man is living longer and longer, but, the young are making more and more foolish mistakes, and it's costing them. Many do not live past their youth then. There is a high price of sowing wild oats. That's a euphemism for being a little bit promiscuous or licentious or however you want to use it in some of the bigger words. A lot of people want to have a good time and trying all kinds of worldly pleasures while they're young. But there should be a caution here. Parents should instill it in the young people. The young people, if you want to be considered mature, have to start taking charge of your own life, making decisions, looking ahead a little bit to see what should be the right paths I should be taking and who should I be listening to. This probably makes sense if you feel that your vitality of youth will absorb the abuse that you're getting into. A lot of people just want to try everything, to see what life has to offer. To take it to the extreme, you don't want to try death because there's no return. That sounds a little ludicrous or whatever, but, seriously, when people start going, young people say, well, the closer you get to death, the more you appreciate life. And this is where the extreme sports come from, where you're doing things that take you to the very edge. Unfortunately, for a lot of them, they don't know where the edge is, and they go over. And you'll find a whole list of people that died too young, as the expression goes, just because they thought they'd live forever. They thought they were Superman. They thought nothing would happen to them. And they were wrong, sadly, tragically. Young people are killed in car crashes all the time. In fact, I was just reading an account of a man and his daughter that were in a car. They were going across an intersection. They got slammed into by another car, and both of them died instantly. The driver of the other car was a young girl who was texting while she was driving. And even while her friends in the back seat were screaming at her to watch the road and quit texting, she was telling them she knows what she's doing, she's got it all under control, and she didn't even have a driver's license, and slammed into the other car and killed him. To die from overdoses of drugs. I was just reading a list that they posted on the internet of all the young people that have died young. Famous celebrities. A lot of them from drug abuse or whatever. Tragically, good careers, and they brought it all to a screaming halt because they weren't mature enough or weren't strong enough to make good decisions. People drop out of school. A lot of times, the young, don't like history lessons. But history gives you an insight into things about, why things are the way they are now and why we should be making the most of them. To look back at the beginning of our country and the sacrifices that had to be made, the wars that were fought on people's own property against enemies in their own backyard, the sacrifices, to the extent, that were made. But also, as to why, even the development of this country, have you ever stopped to think, you may not like going to school, but do you recall there was a time when you didn't have that option? Most of the founders of this country in the early periods of our country, homeschooling was the norm. They didn't go to schools. In fact, if you wanted a college education, you had to go to Europe up until the time of President Wilson. For the longest time, up to like 100 years ago, kids were put in the factories to work, 18-hour shifts. They started coming up with laws to protect child labor when a lot of the young people were falling asleep and falling into the machinery and dying. And so they started structuring things so that you would have an opportunity to go to school past the sixth grade, that the education was free to give you a start in life. And for you to make decisions that cuts that off, you know, is really cutting off the opportunities that people have taken a lot of hard steps in order to give you certain privileges. So when you make bad choices to get, you know, pregnant or, you know, whatever, you're sidelining a good life. Possibilities, opportunities. The Bible teaches us that we will reap what we sow. In Galatians 6, let's put it in modern language, do not be deceived. Don't kid yourself, is what it's saying. God is not mocked. That is, you can't tell God, you know, that, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. I know you're giving me all this stuff, but hey, this is the 20th century, 21st century. Things are different now. And God's trying to tell you, no, they're not. Things aren't different at all. Every person has to start from scratch and go through the educational process, not only of how to live life properly, but also how to control themselves and mature. Everybody starts at square one and goes through that, and you have no advantage than anybody else in history. And if you don't take advantage of God's wisdom and instruction, you're going to take your time period, your centuries or whatever, into a lowness instead of, you know, coming out in the best possible year people could have. Whatever a man sows, this he will reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh, that is, if you pander to just your physical, then you're going to have a life that you're going to be really sad about. It's going to hurt you and hurt everybody around you. And what God is trying to get you to do is to sow the spirit. That is, as you look at yourself, you're not just a body. You're a mind. Okay, and you need to start feeding the mind to get to be thoughtful, logical, rational, reasonable, whatever. If you can't do that, you're going to make a lot of bad mistakes. But even more than that, the spirit, which is tacked on to it. You know, you are spiritual as well. God gave you and made you different than animals by giving you a spirit. And if you don't feed that, if you don't exercise it, then you're going to be prey to everything on this planet. The sowing of wild oats can cost us our health. Check the hospitals, the clinic, and those addicted to smoking, drugs, alcohol. Notice the last part of this. When people say, well, young people say, well, suppose I do this stuff, and they say, you know, it shortens my life. What do I care? I didn't want to live to be 70 or 80 years old anyway. So if I hack off the last part of it, what's the big deal? Well, the problem is it doesn't cut off the last part of it. It cuts off the middle. Have you ever seen someone that you thought you know was in their 70s, but they're really only in their 40s? A friend of my, you know, my wife's, when I first met her, she was very pretty. You know, she had very, you know, very healthy skin, you know, flawless, whatever. Met her again a couple of years, you know, ago, and she's all desiccated and shriveled and whatever. It takes its toll. And you're taking away the quality of life. You know, in fact, in your later years, if you take care of yourself, your 70s or 80s, you know, that's some of the best times of your life, really. You know, if you're up for it, if you're healthy enough, if you're mentally acute for it. But they can cost us careers, losing a chance at a certain college or a certain job because of a crime we committed or an indiscretion. Now, when I was young, you know, in junior high school, and there were sermons like this, the preacher, and I go, I don't know anybody who you're talking about. Nowadays, in this congregation, I know young people that have done everything that we're telling you not to. I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to tell you what they did. I would implore them, because they already realized the mistakes that they've made, to start sharing that with younger people in the congregation. You know, give them your wisdom. Tell them that, you know, that God wasn't kidding when he said, when you do certain things, you could be cutting out opportunities in your life or chances that you may have because of something you did or addicted to or whatever, that's just cutting off every possibility of a really good life, a life that God intended you to have. They can cost us our freedom from one night of riot and revelry. One can lose the trust of their parents, their community, end up locked in jail. They can destroy a happy home, their lives, and or their souls. Often this game of Russian roulette, we are not aware of all that we're placing as a bet. Now, we know the story of Esau. Here's an individual that, you know, he's first in line. He's got a birthright. And the more you understand the birthright, that he, you know, when the father passes away, he gets a double portion of the inheritance. It's going to leave him a wealthy person. Plus, he takes up the role of authority in the place of his father. That means he even has to look after, and, you know, the rest of the family, even his mother. You know, he tells her what to do. He's got full authority. Then we look at Esau, who came in hungry and sold all of that for a mess of soup, a bowl of soup. And we think, what an idiot. Yet people are making the same choices every day, all the time, giving up so much for the stupidest of little things. God is trying to get us to think it through. In Matthew 16, it says, "For what will a man be profit if he gain the whole world and forfeits its soul?" I mean, what Ecclesiastes starts off with, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Start working on a proper character, because where does it all end up? Not just in the grave, but beyond the grave. The spirit goes back to God who gave it. Now that spirit is going to have to face God with what it did with the precious life that God gave it. That's where we're all headed. In the rule of self, now we just got through with the study of Calvinism. Calvinism goes, oh, it's the Holy Spirit that does everything, whatever, God that does everything. The passages like this have no place in the Bible, because God constantly pulls everything back to us. The Bible places a lot of emphasis on the importance of self-control. In Proverbs 16:32 says, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city." What's important? We have a really good example in history. Here's Alexander the Great, supposedly a great conqueror, you know, conquered the known world in about 9 years, about the age of 26. You think, wow, man, he conquered not a city, he's conquered countries. But yet in a fit of rage, threw a javelin through his best friend. He hadn't conquered himself yet. And God is saying, if you really want to be known for somebody, learn to conquer yourself. Because that's harder to do than to conquer a city. As Paul said, I buffet my body and I make it my slave. Okay. That he might be acceptable to God. That he might be acceptable to others. Yeah. What does it good to do to preach to others and that his own life is a shipwreck? We need discipline to rule our actions. 2 Corinthians 5:11 talks about all your deeds. There's going to be a recompense for them, good or evil. Or our words, every careless deed, Matthew 12:36, we'll have to give an account for it. Or every careless word, we're going to have to give an account for. Or our thoughts, Philippians 4:8. You know, Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10, you know, we're to take every thought captive in others and in ourselves. But to the Philippians, he writes, you know, it's a command. you know, whatever is right, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, just, whatever. And it puts in a form of a command. Think on these things. That's a list of things you should be thinking on to crowd out everything that's, you know, that the world is trying to, you know, to pour into us. Or, you know, considering our time, it's limited. Redeeming the time, for the days are evil. And few at that. In our youth, we need to learn not only to say no to the crowd, but just because, you know, we can't use the extreme that everybody's doing it. Well, that makes you nothing more than a lemming. You know what a lemming is? It's a little small rat, and it just keeps following the leader, you know, and eventually, you know, as these things migrate across territory, it comes to the ocean, and the lead ones go off the cliff into the water, and all the rest of them just keep following. Is that what you want to do with your life? Would you like to be one of those that puts the brakes on and go, wait a minute, let me think about this for a second? To do the scenes, the raves, the dances, the drinking parties, the things that are said to make one popular, think about this. I mean, there's things, you know, that the world says, oh, this, you know, this is fun. Really? How is it fun? When you wake up the next morning ashamed of what you did and with a colossal headache or an STD. The drinking bouts. In the raves, I guess, you know, one of the things I understand they do is that they actually put a funnel in a person's mouth and keep pouring alcohol into it. There's a reason you pass out when you drink alcohol on your own. Because there's a certain point where the body goes, if you get any more alcohol in you, it's going to poison you to death. And so the body causes you to pass out for your own protection. And when you jam a lot of alcohol into your system, bypassing all that, it's not just alcohol. You can do the same thing with ice cream. I've known of kids sit there and try to chug a lug ice cream and do the brain freeze and not come out of it. Or the guys that think it's really macho, you know, that you can, you know, take a lot of drinks and not get drunk. You can hold your liquor, the expression goes. You know why you can hold your liquor? Because you've damaged your liver that much. What the world calls macho or smart or fun or whatever, if you start looking at the science of it, you're going to find out it's devastating. It's killing you. Or for a girl to try to be popular by sleeping with other guys, what is she really being popular for? There's an old lesson they gave us in college about a teacher wanted to prove a point. So he brought in, you know, there was 11 kids in the class, and he brought in a dozen roses. And he took out one, and he passed the rose around and let everybody look at it and did a little dissertation on roses and whatever. And then afterwards, he says, okay, as you pass out, you know, from the class, you know, you can take a rose with you. And the kids got up, they came forward, each one grabbed a rose and left. And guess which rose was left? The one that had been passed around. God is trying to tell you how to keep yourself special. Don't ignore him. Be like Joseph, Genesis 36, when Potiphar's wife came on to him, he fled. Flee youthful us. Daniel 1:8, when, you know, they served him food in this land he'd been taken captive to, and he decided that he wasn't going to eat the things that were unclean. And so took steps in order to make sure that he didn't have to. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego told the king to his face, you know, we believe our God will look after us, but even if he doesn't, you know, I love the way they put it, even if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow down to your idol. I'd almost insert the word stupid, because that's pretty much the way they were putting it. You can kill us, but we're still not going to bow down to your golden image. And these are just young kids. but they're taking a stand, in life early. Flee the youthful lust. 1 Corinthians 15:13. We're in the section of pricking your friends. Do not be deceived. God's still trying to warn you. Bad company corrupts good morals. I mean, how are you going to learn something good from people that are being bad all the time? Yeah, that gives you a pick the crowd you're going to stay in, if you're going to be in the crowd. If you run around with the wrong crowd, actually most crowds, you're asking for trouble. You cannot be unique if you pick up all the traits of the herd. Then you're just like anybody else. Choose your friends by high standard. If you want to grow up, hang around grown-ups. Young people used to be considered adults of age 13. Why? Not because they were just 13 and now I can do anything I want. I'm a teenager. It's because they hung around. They did an adult job. They were working with lumberjacks. They were working on the river. They were herding cattle in drives. They were doing a man's job on a daily basis. And they were called upon to a higher standard because they were working around adults. And therefore, they grew up fast. Nowadays, you're still considered an adolescent at age 35 just because our society doesn't call upon you to grow up. When the Bible speaks about Christians being shining lights, though, it does not say just the older Christians or to shine their light. It's talking about the younger ones, too. Young people often are not fully realized the influence they can have on others. The attitudes of the high schoolers can trickle down to those of a lower grade. If you've got a super attitude, you do your lessons, you're enthusiastic about Bible study, you'll be an example to those lower than you in grades. However, if you've got a bad attitude, you want to be lazy, you want to scoff at the Bible and stuff like that, the little ones are going to pick that up. And you're going to answer to God for it later in life. The enthusiasm of young can also stimulate older members. Okay. If the teacher's just got a bunch of kids that come in, they're tired, they don't want to do anything, they're rebellious. How much effort is the teacher going to put into the class? From my own experience, I've attended about 6 different colleges and 2 universities, and a lot of times I had to do that in the morning. A lot of adults, if they're going to take later classes, they go in the evening. But try going to a morning class where the class is full of nothing but kids that have just graduated from high school. They're not used to getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning for an early class. And the minute they come into class, the heads go on the desk and they just start to sleep. Of course, the teacher, he goes through his presentation, but there's no enthusiasm in there. Except when there's another adult. I can recall going in and sitting down and having exchanges, while the rest are just drifting off into nirvana or whatever, and having an intelligent conversation with the teacher and having his eyes light up. He's now got somebody intelligent to talk to. And they love it. I mean, they've studied hard. They've got their degrees in certain subjects, and they want to share it with somebody. And you'd be surprised how much you can set on fire a teacher. I had one class on American history from the Civil War up into the present, and I asked so many questions in there, and the teacher was so enthusiastic, we didn't get past World War I. Which, hint, hint, makes the final a lot shorter. But, you get a lot more out of the teacher. Again, Alexander the Great conquered the world at 26, but he prepared for it, on that side of it. He had the greatest teacher in the world, Aristotle. Not only that, but that period of time, people were enthusiastic about learning. When class was over, what the students would do is go down to the harbor and talk to the sailors getting off the ships and asking them, where have you been? What kind of people were there? What kind of goods were growing? They got a hint of customs, lands they never heard of before. They were self-educating themselves. preparing for life. Yeah, what our young people forget is, you know, you can stay in this little valley and not be called upon to do much. But the minute you step out of this valley, you're competing with the world, where there's a lot of kids that are just, don't want to learn anything. They just want to do their iPods or whatever. There's whole nations of people, Orientals and stuff, that can't get enough education. Why are most of our doctors now Indian? Or our technicians Chinese? Okay, because these kids have a very strong work ethic. And they will be your rulers and your bosses when you get out in the world. The church is not just for old people. When one is baptized in the Lord's church, God expects him to take up the responsibilities of the priesthood. When you become a Christian, you become a priest. You know, to know the law, to be able to teach the law eventually. I mean, there's some societies where a young man, he could be playing with blocks one day, and then he hits that magic age of adulthood, and the adults give him a shield and a spear, and he's out hunting lions with the rest of the guys. There's no period of adolescence whatsoever. And you find that really in the church. You know, when young people say they want to serve the Lord in junior high level, and that's great, but I feel hesitant because I know they're going to hit teenage level. And the world is going to hit them hard, and they're going to forget about the commitment they made to God. The young can teach a class or help assist in teaching a class. They can lead singing, read scripture, preach, help care for the building and the grounds, evangelize, set up Bible classes with friends, visit shut-ins, do anything and should do everything a Christian is supposed to do. I had young people in another place come up to me and go, "Can we start a children's church?" I go, "What? What is a children's church?" If it's a church, it's a convocation made up of God's people. Where do you go from there? What are you doing by yourself that you can't do with the adults? There's no example of a children's church in the Bible. When young people were converted, they took their place among the adults. They're expected to grow up and be like adults. God is giving you that opportunity in this society, in this room, which you're not going to have in the world around you. Prepare today for the roles of leadership you'll have tomorrow. And that's not just, for the world. That's for in the church. Why don't we have elders in this congregation at this time? To be an elder, it takes time and preparation. It takes having a family, being a parent of a good family. Okay. That takes work. It takes a period of time to develop. It takes a growing in respect in the community. It's not just something you can wake up in the morning and go, "Hey, I want to be an elder." No, it's a decision you have to make about 20 years prior. And God is looking for people, that are willing to step into those roles. People that have been responsible to God for a long time. And that's where it comes into a lot of things. If the act of marriage itself ensured that one would live happily ever after, there'd be no divorces. Okay. Why not? A good marriage takes proper pre-planning and training on both people's parts. Either the training in a good family where they have good role models of what it's like to be a good husband or wife, or they've gone to school and gone through the classes, either in church or in school, and took home and family classes and get all the essentials of what needs involved. In fact, this goes back to restructuring ourselves of what love is. It's not a feeling. The agape of the Bible is something that's thought out. It's something that's structured. It's something that looks ahead and shoots for the goal. This is why God says, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments." So loving God is following in line with the structure that God has given you to grow in your life. That's what he's planned. God so loved the world. How did he love it? He loved it thus. He sent his son. He had plans for the world. He had plans to turn it around. And it took a lot of effort. It took the son emptying himself, to coming here and being an example to us, to teach us what the father told him to teach, to die on a cross for us, to be the ultimate sacrifice, and a resurrection to give us hope in the life ever after. That was a lot of work and a labor of love. And our faith requires the same thing. If we love God, you know, we'll make the plans. We'll carry out the things he's given to us. If we love another person, then it means that we've already decided what I need to do in order to be the best possible partner for someone I'm going to hook up with for the rest of my life and the rest of their life. That's planning, and that's a lot of work. And that's what love is. If a guy ever tells you, ladies, that if you love me, you'll sleep with me, that means he doesn't love you. He wants to use you. He's, you know, pushing your buttons and everything else. Because love will go, he will not touch you until you're ready to be married. That's true love. To put it off. To make sure the timing is right, the situation is right, that he's got a good job so he can help support you, that he's taking the classes so he knows what he needs to do to look after you. That's really it. That he's willing to commit, you know, through the vows. It's not a, you know, what the world tells you, well, it's just a piece of paper. No, it's not. It's your character. It's you giving your word that you're going to stay with this person for better or worse, no matter what comes, for the rest of their life. That's your integrity on the line, and that's the vow you made before God. It's not a piece of paper. Yeah. God wants you to get serious about life. He's giving you things that are very precious. And the world has made them profane. You're going to have to work to keep them precious. To marry because of fantasy feeling, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go through these. You've got the handout. I've told people, you know, if you marry, don't marry a Christian. Did I get your attention? Marry a good Christian. There's a difference. Good Christian means that they're convicted, they're converted individuals who show spiritual maturity and persevering devotion to God and are not just attending services because their parents make them come. They're there on their own. They're there because they want to learn and they want to worship God. Things to consider. I might as well do this. Do not think that you're going to convert them. Find somebody who's already converted, who's made up their mind to do the right thing. It's easier to fall than to fly. It's easier for them to pull you down to a level than for you to pull them up again. Try the little exercise we did in home and family class. Stand on a chair and grab their hand and see which is easier, to pull them up on the chair or for them to pull you off the chair. Things to think about. If you want a Porsche, buy or marry a Porsche. Don't get yourself a Volkswagen, think you can convert it. Bottom line of this, find somebody you can be a friend to. Somebody you can sit down with, work things through, face problems with, have a good time with, you know, just sitting. Most of you know that Olin Hudson, you know, was my nephew. Some of you had him as, you know, preacher here earlier. I still get a kick out of him and Angie sitting on, you know, they've been married probably longer than Nancy and I have. And they still sit on the couch and kind of giggle like two little kids, you know, just sharing, you know, little things. That's the kind of person you want. Somebody you can share life with. The big things, the little things, the in-between things, you know, sadness, you know, happiness, all these kind of stuff. You know, that's what you're looking for. And finances, mutual understanding, marry someone who is a friend. The last thing I said in the last little thing is, what gets me is that India has a population that's rivaling China. You know, it's over 1 billion people in India. Just about every marriage there is arranged. The parents pick, you know, who's going to marry who. Divorce rate? Why? Well, customs for one thing, but also they leave it to someone who knows what to look for in a marriage. Not to somebody who doesn't know anything about marriage, who's just fumbling around, who may have hormones kicking in and stuff like that. They leave it to people who've been there, done that, and know what is the best possible partner to pick. This is why for centuries, marriages have been arranged. Okay, and when you start talking about, well, did they really love them? I defy you to define what love is. A lot of the definitions I get, it sounds like something you stepped in and can't get it off the bottom of your feet. People that are, oh, I'm so in love with this person, and then they get divorced 2 or 3 years later or 6 months later. They have no idea what love is. You owe it to yourself to come up with a good working definition before you step into anything. You know, what makes it work? What's going to make it last? You know, what are you going to put into it? You know, not just 50%, but 110%. When both are putting in that much, it'll work. And then finally, respecting parents. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. Nowadays, kids say, well, I'm 18, I'm 16, I don't have to listen to my parents anymore. I'm growing up. For the longest time, and for most civilizations, you never outgrew the authority of your parents. If you were Caesar and head of the whole Roman Empire, if you offended your parents, they could have you executed. Think about that. It's part of a biblical concept too. You always are supposed to respect your parents. In fact, as you get older, perhaps your parents will begin to appear a little bit more smarter than you took them for. It's almost a joke with Mark Twain. So he thought his dad was just a kind of an oaf, an idiot, and it surprised him how much smarter the old guy got the older he got. That's what happens. You know, our parents are really, they're there for us. That's why God gave us parents. Even in later life, even as we're developing and getting older, so are they. They still keep growing in experience and insight. You may want to consult them all the way through your life and not try to cut it off at 18 or something like that and then go your own way. You're not prepared for life yet. Okay. Again, God is not mocked. Listen to him. He's giving you some good advice. Just look around you. There's so many young people here that have gone through several marriages because they set out thinking they knew it all and doing it on their own. Okay. If that's the kind of marriage you want, listen to your friends. But if you want a marriage that's great and it's going to last you for your whole lifetime so that you'll have a fellow partner with you in later life, so you won't be lonely and you'll be able to share things with and help each other, go to the people in the congregation that have been married 30 to 60 years and keep asking them, what did you do to make it work? What kind of mindsets? What sort of labor did you put into it? Yeah. I started doing that when I got to the age of looking for a partner. I mean, there's things the world will tell you. Okay, don't take somebody else's partner. If they'll cheat with you, they'll cheat on you. Okay, I started asking couples, especially the ones, oh man, you've got a really perfect marriage here. How did you do? How do you do it? Most of them will tell me, man, there were some times when we could have killed each other. But they worked it out. And that's what makes it last. They worked it out. I know there's an old joke about this woman who married to her husband almost 60-80 years or something like that, and she was getting on. And this guy was interviewing her and said, you've lived all this time. Have you always been happy? And she goes, yeah, pretty much. And he goes, have you ever thought of divorce? And she goes, no, never thought of divorce. Murder, yes, but never divorce. You can work it out. You know, God has given you all the rules to work it out. And that's what you're looking for. People that can help you do that, who have the secret of all of this, to help you get along in life, to have your life be a lot better, to help you along the way. In fact, this is why we encourage you to keep looking to God. He designed us. He knows what's best for us. He put all this together at the very beginning of creation. And in fact, you're about to sing a song, Trust and Obey. That's what it's getting to. This is one of the things you do with God. You trust Him, which means when you begin to obey, you're putting your faith in Him, that He knows what He's talking about. And even if you may even think you kind of disagree with Him or something, you're still going to go along and do it His way, because you know in the final analysis, that's going to be the right way. And for our closing here, this is what we need to do with God's in every aspect of our life. To turn ourselves over to Him. He calls upon us to repent of our world, to confess Him as Lord, to enter the waters of baptism, have our sins washed away, and then keep walking in the light, to be steadfast in that and persevering, so that we'll be with Him for eternity. If there's anything we can do to help you with that, please let us know as we stand to sing.